Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
We're going to start tonight in Numbers 31, so turn there. Most of what we're going to see tonight is based on things we've already seen, things we already know. Chapter 31 assumes that you already know the things that you read back in chapter 25. And even though our teaching of these events has been separated by many weeks, when the actual narrative was written, when the words were written down, these things were all concurrent, all part and parcel of the same history. So we have to remember that there was a guy named Balaam, and that he was hired by the kings of Midian to curse Israel. And after three attempts of cursing Israel and ending up blessing them, the next chapter begins by telling us that the Israelite men started cavorting with the local Midianite women, and as a consequence began becoming involved in idol worship, for which God killed 24,000 men. So you've got to hold on to that reality first, that God, in seeing that they were worshiping foreign gods, after having given them the command, "You will have no other gods before me," that God personally brought about a plague, and that plague killed 24,000 Israelites. But now, starting in chapter 31, even though God has punished Israel for their failure to follow what he told them to do, now in chapter 31, God punishes the Midianites for the fact that they were responsible for wanting to curse Israel and for leading Israel astray. However, when God takes out his vengeance on the Midianites, rather than doing it directly like he did with his people, he sends an Israelite army to go beat up on the Midianites. Not just beat up on them, but slaughter them. And then take all their stuff. And then, quite remarkably, at the end of it, there's a count taken of the 12,000 soldiers from Israel that went to war against the Midianites. And when the count is taken, not a single Israelite is dead. Not a single Israelite is missing. God protected his entire army of his people and used them to punish the Midianites. So we really have this contrast here between God taking personal responsibility for bringing about a plague on his people for their failure to worship him alone. In other words, when they worship the Midianite gods, God brought about a plague, and that's the way we're told. God brought about the plague, and then it was finally stopped when a man was driven through with a spear. God was satisfied with that, and God stopped the plague. But then when it comes time to take vengeance on the Midianites, God doesn't put a plague on them, or put a flood on them, or put an earthquake on them, or cause a drought for them. He sends his people in. He actually uses means in order to accomplish his vengeance on them. So let's start by reading it, and then we're going to talk about some of the implications of those facts that I just laid out. Chapter 31. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Take full vengeance for the sons of Israel on the Midianites." This is really interesting because Israel was guilty. They were absolutely guilty of cavorting with the Midianite women and chasing after the Midianite gods. So guilty, in fact, that God did bring about a plague that killed 24,000 men. So they were absolutely guilty. But then God holds the Midianites guilty for the fact that they came and persuaded the Israelite men to chase after their women and chase after their gods. So God says, now take full vengeance for the sons of Israel. In this instance, God is protecting his chosen, the Israelites, and taking out his vengeance against the Midianites. Afterward, You shall be gathered to your people. That's God telling Moses, this is going to be your last act. Follow through with my vengeance against the Midianites, and then you're going to die. And Moses spoke to the people, saying, arm men from among you for the war, that they may go against Midian to execute the Lord's vengeance on Midian. So it's very clear. The language is very specific. Get ready to go to war in order to execute God's vengeance against the Midianites. 1,000 from each tribe of all the tribes of Israel you shall send to the war. So they were furnished from the thousands of Israel, 1,000 from each tribe, 12,000 armed for war. Now that number, 12,000, is just interesting because it was exactly twice that was the number that fell in the plague. It was 24,000. So that's roughly 2,000 from each tribe. Now God takes half as many as he killed, 1,000 from each tribe, and sends them into this war, and they all come back fine. God protects every one of them. And Moses sent them, 1,000 from each tribe, to the war, and Phinehas, the son of Eleazar the priest, to the war with them, and the holy vessels and the trumpets for the alarm in his hand. That's real interesting, the fact that they sent the priest this time with the holy vessels and the trumpets means that this was a holy war. Well, let's talk about some of these implications for a moment, because it's clear that in the Ten Commandments, God includes don't kill. Thou shalt not kill. I've told you before, the best translation of it is most likely do no murder. And yet, here we have God saying, go kill those people. Is God contradicting himself? Is God counteracting an earlier commandment? No. Once in a while, it is absolutely right to go to war for a just cause. In this case, the just cause is defending the honor and vengeance of God. And God's honor and God's righteousness and holiness deserve a defense. And so in this instance, not only does he send his people into the war, but he protects them in the war, and they all come back. So he sends a priest with them, so they have an intercessor. They have the holy vessels with them and the trumpets that are used for the gathering, typically, of Israel, and to let Israel know when it's time to move, when the cloud and the pillar of smoke would rise up and move. They would use the trumpets to gather the assembly. All of this is being implemented in this war. Proof that God is in it and that God is protecting his people in it and that sometimes there is a just cause for war. Were you going to say something?
But God brings glory to himself so that the gossips would know that God is powerful. The God of the Israelites is powerful. Is this one of the points that's going to be made later on?
Yeah, well, absolutely. And it's part and parcel of the big picture of God spreading the fear of Israel among all the peoples of the land so that the people will know, number one, that there is a God in Israel, that he's a real God, that he delivered all these people out of Egypt, and that everywhere these people go, they're a terror. So if they're coming after you, be afraid. I mean, God is continually making sure that all the residents around there understand that God is for Israel, which is a reality that our modern world and even so much of the modern church has lost touch with. Nowhere in the Bible do you read a statement that says, at this moment, at this point, because of these events, God is now finished with Israel. Instead, what you see consistently is Paul asking the question, like in Romans 11, what will we say then? Has God abandoned the people whom he foreknew? And Paul's answer is, may it never be. God forbid. He has never abandoned his people because they are referred to as God's chosen, God's elect. Paul brings it up later in that same chapter and says, as touching the gospel, they are enemies for your sakes, you Gentiles' sakes. For you Gentiles, Israel are enemies of the gospel. But then he says, but as touching the election, they are beloved for the Father's sake. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the ones who received the promises in the first place. So it's consistent throughout the Bible that God is for Israel, despite the fact that Israel has a long, rich history of not always being for God. And as a consequence, at this particular moment, God is concentrating on the Gentiles, the church, all of that. But Paul says, again in Romans 11, all consistent theology here, he says that when the fullness of the Gentiles has come in, then all Israel will be saved. So however we define all Israel, they are separate from the all Gentiles, they are separate from the church, and they are identified as people who are currently enemies of the gospel. And so we can't say that all Israel in Romans 11 is the church, or all the elect, or all the saved of all ages. They've been defined, that phrase, all Israel, has been defined many, many different ways by folks through the years who don't bother to look at the next phrase, which is, as touching the gospel, they're enemies for your sakes. So we have to say that there is a group identified as all Israel who have the characteristic of being enemies of the gospel, but they're not written off. God isn't finished with them. God is interested right now in apparently the church and bringing in the full number of the Gentiles. And when he has accomplished that, he turns his attention back to those who are enemies of the gospel, who are beloved for the Father's sake.
That they will come to the Lord through Christ, you would have to, because he's the only way.
All salvation is ultimately through Christ. Absolutely. Absolutely. But Zechariah even gives you a clue about that and says that when Christ returns, they will look on him whom they have pierced and weep as a mother weeps over her only child. Yes, salvation is only through Christ. But it's very common these days to hear different variations of the notion that God has written Israel off once and for all, and that now his attention is solely and completely in the church, and once the church age is finished, that wraps up everything. But that's not what Paul says. He still says there is this group, Israel, who are enemies of the gospel, who nevertheless are beloved and elect. And we have to deal with that.
Are we talking about those that have died, those in the bosom of Abraham?
I have to be careful here and say, I have to say two things. Number one, I'm in the middle of writing a huge article on Romans 11, which is why the stuff is all fresh in my mind. But we also have to be real careful about how specific we get with it. Because we know for a fact that there are some Israelites, like the ones that Jesus condemned, and Judas, who are not saved. So all Israel can't mean absolutely every individual who ever was a part of national Israel. Exactly.
Gentiles are not saved.
Exactly. Without belaboring the point right now, chapter 11 is amazingly consistent and coherent, which is why I'm taking the time to write this big article for the website right now. I am convinced, because of the example early in the chapter, the example of the cut-off branches. Are we familiar with this? The cut-off branches off the olive tree, and then Paul identifies the wild branches that were grafted in against their nature, and it's clear that those are the Gentiles. But then he doesn't explain the allegory. Well, my feeling is the reason he didn't explain the allegory is because he didn't have to. To his original readers, the allegory was so obvious that he didn't have to explain it. Now, what they all knew historically was that Israel nationally had been broken into the northern and the southern kingdoms. And that while the southern kingdom was still intact, the northern tribes had been dispersed and the languages, they had been cut off. And so the northern scattered cut off tribes, Jesus identified as the lost tribes, the lost sheep of the house of Israel, they were still locatable, they were still findable, but they had been cut off from their history, they've been cut off from the temple, they've been cut off from their heritage. And so I see Paul's example of cut-off branches as being exactly that, the northern cut-off tribes, because the language is consistent. And then Paul explains, they were cut off, you were grafted in. So when he says, when the fullness of the Gentiles is brought in, then all Israel is saved, all Israel in that instance is all 12 tribes, which is consistent with everything we read from all the prophets in the Old Testament that say that Israel nationally will be regathered, all 12 tribes. You go to the book of Revelation, 144,000, 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes. There's this very consistent language of a regathering of all 12 tribes. When you've regathered people from all 12 tribes, you've regathered all Israel without having to gather every single individual who was ever called an Israelite. I think Paul was speaking nationally of the tribes of Israel that were cut off that will be grafted back into their own promises. That's my sense of Romans 11, and I will prove it to you when you get a chance to read the article, because I go through all the language in specificity to prove that point. But once you see it that way, all the conundrums clear up. All the problems go away, and you find that Paul, being a Jew, in writing in Romans 11, is saying exactly and consistently what all Israel's prophets have always said. And the problem comes when people attempt to use Paul's writing in Romans 9, 10, and 11 to create some new thing. I'm arguing for consistency in the Bible, that Paul is simply saying God is still keeping the promises to national Israel that he's always made, which is why he says, has God abandoned those that he foreknew, the Israelites, who he identifies as my brethren after the flesh, who are Israelites? Has God abandoned them? No. Then he repeats the promises that all the Old Testament prophets repeat, that one day there will be a regathering and reconstitution of all 12 tribes so that Israel as a nation is complete. Well, Paul's saying the same thing. And that makes much more sense than all of the new theories that are flying around right now.
But God couldn't lie. I mean, he couldn't lie and make it this way one place and something.
Precisely. And isn't that what I've always argued for, is continuity of the Bible?
Right.
If God said it, he's going to do it. So when people attempt to
twist it
and place Paul as somehow against the Old Testament prophets, we have all these great Old Testament prophecies, but then Paul comes along and says, no, that's all gone.
New story,
new deal, here's God's done with Israel. And people attempt to do that. I'm arguing quite the opposite. I'm arguing that God is completely consistent with himself in his own word.
And then he goes into Hebrews about all of that.
Of course.
So, okay.
I like your response. Yes, Sally's response was, so there, there it is. Now, okay, so we sort of got a little off track here. Oh, don't apologize. I'm the one who took us off track. You all just willingly followed. So now what I was talking about is consistency with God using means. When it came time for him to punish the Midianites, he used the Israelites to punish the Midianites. So the Israelites followed the Midianites, chased after their gods, and God directly punished the Israelites. But then God held the Midianites accountable for their participation and used the Israelites to punish the Midianites for challenging their God, so that the reputation of God and the God of Israel would be a reputation of power and consistency, and you don't want to mess with Israel because they have a real God. But what you see again is God using means. And this is something that I end up having to discuss and debate with people all the time, because as soon as we say that the God of the Bible is absolutely sovereign, not just a king on his throne who acts willy-nilly, but an absolute sovereign who's in charge of throwing lots and sparrows and feeding baby lions and hanging the universe. The God who does all that, the one who we argue whatever happens in God's universe is exactly what God intended to have happen in his universe. That's how we characterize and represent God to be. As soon as we do that, the anti-reformed voices out there in the world will say, well, if your God is absolutely sovereign, then he's also the author of sin. Have you heard that argument before? And, of course, they'll go for the very horrible emotional argument. They can't argue scripture, so they'll go with the emotional argument, like, well, then you're saying, if a 12-year-old girl is beaten badly by a stepfather and locked in a basement and starved to death and sexually abused for her whole life, and you're saying God's responsible for that.
Hey, use the Holocaust as a better example.
The Holocaust is a prime example, isn't it? Because it's easier for our conscience to say, if something good happens, that's God at work because God is good and loving. But if something bad happens, like an earthquake that wrecks Haiti, you got to say, well, okay, that wasn't God. Somehow God wasn't in that, or God didn't see that coming, or it's the devil. It's just evil. It's just bad. And it's funny that in the press, as people struggled to describe the devastation in Haiti, that they used biblical language because they didn't know where else to resort to try to explain how bad the devastation was. I saw one headline that said, you know, destruction of biblical proportion, because they don't know how else to describe it. But the only reason they can use the term biblical proportion is that they know the Bible is chock full of destruction and killing and wiping people out and this kind of destruction brought about by a sovereign God. Yes, sir.
Hitler believed that he was put in place by God, and he might have been right.
Right. The difference being that when people invoke the name of God, usually we think, well, he was put in place by God to do good.
Oh.
But Pharaoh? Pharaoh was put in place on purpose and hardened and destroyed for God's glory. Now, the same God is still at work in the world. The same God who was willing to kill 24,000 of his own people because they chased after a foreign God is the same God who's going to use 12,000 of his own people to wipe Midian off the map, kill all the men of Midian, and then take all their stuff and all their cattle and all their sheep and all their women. And then when they come back with the women, Moses says to them, what are you doing? The women were the problem. They're the ones that started all this. And then they kill the women. Now that sounds harsh. And people want to take all of that and relegate it to the Old Testament. Push it back into the Old Testament of the Bible and say, well, we understand that the Hebrew Bible and the Christian Bible, we understand that it includes problems of biblical proportion, but those problems happened way back then, and it's different now, and God is different now. He's much more tolerant now, and if something bad happens on the planet, God could have prevented it or should have or wanted to or tried and just couldn't do anything about it, and then bad happened because sometimes bad stuff just happens and God can't do anything about it. Well, you don't find a God like that anywhere in the Bible. Instead, you find a God who is responsible for both the good and the bad that happens in his universe, and he's perfectly willing to dole out vengeance. And sometimes he doles out that vengeance directly through what we currently call an act of God, which is a phrase that allows your insurance company to not pay out after the tornado or the flood or the, you know, sorry, act of God, can't do anything about it. Even in companies that are godless companies, they use the phrase act of God because sometimes things happen that you can't attribute to anything other than God did this. Sometimes God does it directly. Sometimes God uses means. Now, it's understanding God's use of means that will allow us to deal with the charge that our representation of God makes God the author of sin. It's clear from what we've read of God punishing Israel, it's clear that God is perfectly willing to dole out bad events. He brought about a plague that killed 24,000. God's perfectly willing to do that. The question is, does that make him evil? No, it makes him holy. It makes him righteous. It makes him a judge. And it makes him a God that you don't play with. If he says it, that's the truth. You understand it. You get in line with it. You abide by it because he's a righteous judge. It does not make him evil. Can God then still maintain his holiness and lack of sinfulness and still allow a girl to go through what I described earlier? Well, yeah, because we even see examples of that in the Bible. We see God bringing about such horror on Israel later on. They are going to reach the point of such hunger, and God is going to punish them so badly that mothers will boil babies. It's a horrible passage. And it happened. It's a terrible thing to punish them for not doing what he said to do. Does that make God evil? Does it make God the author of sin? Sometimes Israel did sinful things, like chase foreign gods. God punished them for it. Is God the author of the sin? Well, now we have to be careful because we say Satan is the author of sin, but does that make God and Satan active enemies and equal? No, and this is where we got to get our theology straight. Satan is a created creature who does God's bidding. He is what I just called the means. He is the means by which God is doing what God intends to do. In the book of Revelation, God throws Satan into the lake of fire and destroys him forever. Can't he do that anytime he wants? Why isn't he doing it? Because he doesn't want to. Because he still has a use for him. It still serves God's purpose. Now, does the fact that God allows Satan to go about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour, to this very moment, does that make God evil? I mean, he could stop Satan, but he doesn't. Why doesn't he? And Satan brings about all kind of sin in the world. And so God could stop Satan from doing that, but he doesn't. Does that make God the author of the sin? No, because God uses means. Let's take it back to the very beginning. Let's make it as obvious as we can make it. Okay, the first sin on the planet was Adam and Eve. Eve eating a forbidden fruit. That was the sin that plunged all mankind into sinfulness and darkness and spiritual separation from God. We all agree with that, right? Mm-hmm. It's the reason that people get old and die, right? It's a bad thing. It's a curse that has even cursed the planet so that weeds grow up and choke good fruit. So we understand that the curse is real and it's a direct result of a man's sin. Now, when Adam and Eve sinned, were they acting in accordance with God's will, or were they acting against God's will? There's the big question.
Oh, the
answer is yes. Oh! Yeah, at first, Marilyn said against, and then she went, wait? Yeah, and so Conrad wisely said the answer is yes. God's will was to glorify his son. And so his son is identified as the lamb slain before the foundation of the world.
Okay. So man had to sin.
And so man had to sin in order for there to be people for the son to save.
Right.
What's the point of identifying him as the lamb slain before the foundation of the world if God created the world with the expectation that the world would be perfect? Mm-hmm. And in fact, had God not intended for the sin to happen, why create the temptation?
Why put the
tree in the garden? Just keep the tree out of the garden.
And tell them no.
Well, you don't even have to tell them no.
Yeah.
You just don't put the tree there. Now look, if you and I can figure out don't put the tree there, because we've raised children, and we know that when you tell a child don't do that, the best thing to do is remove the temptation. If you say don't take any cookies out of the cookie jar, the smartest thing to do is to put the cookie jar up so high the kid can't get it. Remove the temptation. Now, if you and I know that, God could figure that out. So God puts the temptation in the garden and then points at it. And says, okay, now you see that? Don't touch that. I'm going to leave it right there where you can get to it. Don't touch that. Now, could God have kept Satan out of the garden?
Yes.
Sure, absolutely. God's everywhere at once. He's all-knowing. He has all the power. He knew that Satan fell in some point in eternity past. He knew that Satan was an enemy who rebelled against him and said, I will set up my throne in the place of the north. I will be worshipped as God. God knew that that was Satan's intention. Why didn't he put him right in the lake of fire right then? He didn't want to. He had a plan at work. And so he put Satan, or at least allowed Satan, in the garden. So now you've supplied the temptation and the tempter. And then, apparently, God is essentially absent while Eve is talking to the serpent. Don't you think God knew that conversation was happening? There's only two people on the planet. I mean, he could very easily have interrupted the conversation and said to Satan, get out of here. These are my people. You got no business talking to her. Get away from her. But God didn't. So the fall occurred, and the end result in all eternity, the end result of the fall is going to be the glory of Jesus Christ. Because God has a plan at work. Now God put the temptation in place. He allowed the tempter in. He didn't stop the conversation. And then when the fall happened, he held Adam and Eve guilty. He held Satan guilty. And he throws everybody out of his garden. Was he the author of that sin?
No.
Why? He used means. He used Satan. He used Satan to accomplish his ultimate goal. God did not cause the sin. As Gladys rightly said, Satan's responsible for it. And God judged him as if he was responsible for it. But it all served God's ultimate purpose. And you see that throughout the Bible. Sometimes we use the word here, compatibilism, to say that the sinfulness of man still ends up working right into the ultimate plan of God. That even the sinfulness and wretchedness and depravity of men end up serving God's ultimate purpose. And there are several examples of it in the Bible. The most obvious of them, of course, is Peter standing up at the day of Pentecost and saying to the Jews, you, with wicked hands, killed the Prince of Life. And you did exactly what God intended you would do. Peter goes right down the list. He says, the Jews and the Gentiles and Herod and Pilate were all gathered together to do whatsoever your hand and your counsel decreed to be done. So they all, through their wickedness, did exactly what they wanted to do and did exactly what God intended to do. So were they guilty? Yeah, absolutely. Was God the author of that horrible sin? No. Did that horrible sin have to happen? The crucifixion of the only innocent one? Yes, of course it had to happen. He used means to accomplish it so that he remains holy, spotless, sinless, and yet at the same time, absolutely sovereign. Did you catch all that? Did you follow that? Well, that's what we're seeing going on here. Here we see God punishing Israel back in chapter 25 for chasing after these foreign women, holding them responsible and directly taking vengeance on them in order to prove his own holiness and to defend his righteousness and to show that he's not messing around when he makes laws. Here in chapter 31, he's going to take out his vengeance on Midian. But now he uses the children of Israel to do it. He uses means to do it, even though he's completely sovereign over it. Got it? See, theology helps. When you get your doctrine straight, you don't have problems with the Bible.
All right, well, what will mankind be different from Adam and Eve, the resurrected people?
Absolutely, yeah. No sin nature.
Mm-hmm. Well, did they have a sin nature before they sinned?
You know, there's no correct answer to that question because the Bible doesn't tell us what their nature was. Here's what we know. We know that they were naked and unashamed. And then immediately after the fall, they sewed together fig leaves because they knew they were naked. So what we see is a change in their own self-perception. And when they heard God, they ran from him and hid. They had always been in communion with him. Now they're ashamed. They know they've sinned. They run, they hide.
All right. They lost their innocence.
They lost their innocence.
All right. What will we have gained that's different from that?
Oh, very good question. Here's what we will have that they did not have. Christ-likeness sustaining us. They did not have that. What Paul says is, we don't know what it'll be like when Christ returns, but what we know is we'll be like him. And he is in a perfect, spotless, unblemished condition. So will we be.
All right, now what I've been wondering about is this. Was this the only way that God could implant his spirit within man? Was it impossible for God to have done that before the fall and the sin?
There's, again, no way to answer that because it's a hypothetical question saying, you know, could God have done it differently? Knowing that he's God and he's infinite in his mind, I end up having to say, yeah, there were probably other choices. But he, in his great wisdom, decided that this was the method that would optimize the glory that would come to him and his son. Because his whole purpose is the glorification of his son.
All right, but it'll forever be a witness to the fact that God loves man.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And let me add one more thing. Had he not done it this way, we would never understand that God was gracious. There are characteristics of God, characteristics of his personality that wouldn't have shown without him doing it this way. Things like unconditional love, things like mercy, things like judgment against his enemies, and things like long-suffering and grace and kindness toward those that he loves and elects and chooses. All of those grand themes are demonstrated by the methodology that he's chosen to use. Yes, he could have just created men and then made them perfect, made the earth perfect, and then just carried on that way. But what does that demonstrate? It just demonstrates that he's a creator. But in what way could he demonstrate that he was gracious or forgiving or kind or loving or merciful? How does he demonstrate all that?
In other words, Adam and Eve were just made in the image of God, but not in the character and disposition of God necessarily.
Right. Because here's what we know for sure. Christ, perfect, sinless, did not sin, and there's a lot of philosophical arguments about whether he could sin. I say that since he was tempted in all points such as we are, yet without sin, that for it to be genuine and real, that we have to say, well, he was tempted in every way and didn't sin, and therefore the possibility existed, but because he's perfect in God, he did not sin. Okay, well, that's how we're going to be. Adam and Eve weren't like that. Adam and Eve were innocent, but they weren't incapable of sin because they did sin. They weren't incapable of falling because they did fall. They weren't incapable of dying because once they rebelled, they did die. But what's different for us is in the resurrection, we're told no more sickness, no more death. No possibility of death.
All right, then what's the option that I'm going to stop?
Okay, these are good questions. These are all good questions.
Could they have eaten of the tree of life instead of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil?
They did. They were free to eat from the tree of life whenever they wanted. In fact, do you remember why the angel with the flaming sword was put at the gate when they were driven east of Eden?
Right, so they couldn't eat of the tree.
So they didn't have access to the tree of life.
All right, now if they had eaten of the tree of life, wouldn't that have made them so they wouldn't die?
Well, there's a couple ways to answer that question, but here's what we know. Revelation 22, tree of life shows up again.
Yes.
River of life, tree of life, right. And anyone who wants to eat freely.
And that's going to be my job. I'm going to take the medicine from the tree of life and take it to the nations.
You have a mission.
For the healing of the nations.
For the healing of the nations, yeah. So what we know for sure is, once the fall happened, God sent an angel to keep people from the tree of life. It disappears to history. Whatever happened to it, it's gone. It's not here anymore. But it's going to be. And it's going to be part of the New Jerusalem, and whoever wants to, take it freely. Like bookends, the beginning of Genesis and the end of Revelation are the two places that talk about the tree of life. And the people who have access to it have free access to it. But as long as men are sinful and dying, no access to the tree of life. So in order for men to continue dying under the curse, which every generation has done up until now, God has to keep the tree of life away. Once we're resurrected, eternal life, New Jerusalem, God's done with the whole sin problem. He has proven his point. He has shown his grace. He has exercised his mercy. He has poured out his judgment. He's demonstrated everything he means to demonstrate in this great, grand, earthly experiment. Once he's done everything he's going to do, the tree of life is available to whoever wants it again, like the river of life. But in between, we live in this moment now where we get sick and get old and die, so that God can demonstrate both his mercy and his great power in bringing us up out of the dirt again. So God's in the enterprise of glorifying himself in everything he does. And that's really the only point I'm trying to make tonight. Whatever God does, it is motivated by God's revelation of himself and the glorification of God and his Son. And that includes everything, even the stuff that we humans say, that's just awful. That's horrible. The girl in the basement with the stepfather. Okay, awful. Terrible. Hitler, 6 million Jews. Terrible. Awful. Joseph sold into slavery. Terrible. Awful. And yet Joseph ends up saying to his brothers, you meant it for evil, God meant it for good. Because what we don't see is we don't see why that girl was treated like that or where God's going to get glory out of it. What we know is God's going to get glory out of it. We don't see the big picture where Hitler and the Holocaust are concerned. What we know for sure is the same God who has always existed is getting glory for himself. Always. If we just lived good terrestrial lives with no sin, and then we went to heaven, is there really any reason to worship him? Because we all just were there, and now we're here, and it's just part of the... Eh. But you will have no trouble in all eternity forever worshiping the Savior who utterly, completely saved you when you see the distance between your wretchedness, yeah, and how he glorifies us. And when we see that, we're going to glorify Christ, which is his purpose to begin with, which is the glorification of God and his Son. Right? All right, let's make a little progress here, and I'll let you go for tonight. I just wanted to pull all of that out of these first six verses so that you can see the hand of God at work through means. And as soon as you understand that God works through means, you can answer some of those big theological conundrums. And I'm just happy to have used the term theological conundrums tonight. Thank you.
No idea what you're talking about.
So, verse 7, so they made war against Midian, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. And they killed every male, and they killed the kings of Midian, along with the rest of their slain, Evi and Rechem and Zur and Hur and Reba, the five kings of Midian. And they also killed Balaam, the son of Beor, with the sword. And the sons of Israel captured the women of Midian and their little ones and all their cattle and all their flocks and all their goods. They plundered those. And then they burned all the cities where they lived and all their camps with fire. And they took all the spoil and all the prey, both of man and of beast, and they brought the captives and the prey and the spoil to Moses and to Eleazar the priest and to the congregation of the sons of Israel to the camp of the plains of Moab, which are by the Jordan opposite Jericho. And Moses and Eleazar the priest and all the leaders of the congregation went out to meet them outside the camp. And Moses, I'm sure they were going, man, he's going to be thrilled. We knocked this one out of the park. And we are bringing back all this booty. I mean, look at the stuff we're bringing back. He is going to really be pleased. And Moses was angry with the officers of the army, the captains of thousands and the captains of hundreds, who came from the service in the war. And Moses said to them, have you spared all the women? Behold, these caused the sons of Israel, through the counsel of Balaam, to trespass against the Lord in the matter of Peor. So the plague was among the congregation of the Lord. Now, therefore, kill every male among the little ones, and kill every woman who has known a man intimately, because that apparently was the methodology by which the women had attracted the men of Israel. They had used their sexual wiles, as women are wont to do, in order to attract the men. And don't you... She shook her head at me. Can I get a witness?
Amen.
All right.
Got the t-shirt.
And so every woman who was a virgin was spared, verse 18, but all the girls who have not known a man intimately, spare them for yourselves. And you, camp outside the camp for 7 days, whoever has killed any person. This is interesting too, because it's God who said, go do the killing. And now he's saying to them, now because you've killed, you're unclean. You can't come back in the camp for 7 days. You have to clean yourself, you have to clean your clothes, and even all the stuff you took from them is unclean because it was stuff that belonged to heathens. So you have to purify it and clean it before you can even bring it into the camp. Camp outside the camp for 7 days. Whoever has killed any person and whoever has touched any slain, purify yourselves, you and your captives, on the third day and on the seventh day. And you shall purify for yourselves every garment and every article of leather and all the work of goat's hair and all the articles of wood. And then Eleazar the priest said to the men of war who had gone to battle, this is the statute of the law which the Lord has commanded Moses. Only the gold and the silver, the bronze and the iron, the tin and the lead, everything that can stand the fire, you shall pass through the fire, and it shall be clean. But it shall be purified with water for impurity. But whatever cannot stand the fire, you shall pass through the water, and you shall wash your clothes on the seventh day and be clean, and afterward you can enter into the camp. Starting then at verse 25, that's where we'll pick up next week, God is then going to divide up everything they brought back, because they brought back animals and they brought back people and they brought back, as you just heard, gold and silver and stuff. They brought back furnishings. They brought back all kinds of stuff. God's going to divide it up. And he's going to take half of it and give it to everybody who went to the fight. That's 12,000 people who get to divide that one. Then the other half goes to all Israel, which means if you didn't go to the fight, you got a little bit. If you went to the fight, you got a bigger bit. So God is incredibly fair. But then, just as they're about to divide it up, God goes, ah, me first. First you give me mine, and God takes a tax of everything that they brought back. He takes his portion and then gives the rest to Israel in two divisions. So we'll get into all that next week, because it teaches us some great things about God's view of your stuff. Because not only does he require his portion, but then he lets them enjoy their portion. So for those of you who can't be here next week, one of the things we're going to learn next week is, see, I just never did get to everything tonight. We're going to learn that it's perfectly okay to enjoy what God gives you. If he gives you stuff, enjoy the stuff he gave you. Be thankful for it. Just make sure you give him his. And then enjoy what's yours. All right? A lot of good questions, good conversation tonight. I know it was heavy, I know it was a lot of theology, but theology and sound doctrine will clear up a lot of our biblical problems. Anything else? Good, good conversation tonight.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.